Well, it's as Professor Shevitz says, the art of the New Deal. I thought I've had various iterations of the title for this paper. I've been trying to figure out what to do with it. I thought, given today that there's an election, some of you may have heard of, going on in the United States, with the author of the New Deal is one of the, the art of the deal being one of the people contesting. I thought it was appropriate to use this pun title. The New Deal actually is a fairly important aspect of at least the historical context in which what I want to talk about occurs. Let me tell you, this is an unusual paper. It's an unusual paper for me to be writing. I'm usually more interested in sort of innovative finance, what's new. This is very much what's old. But the way I came to this was most people here, certainly most people at Canadian and American law schools, and I suspect here as well in the English-speaking world, are familiar with the Dodd-Burley debate on the pages of the Harvard Law Review in 1931-32. When I was looking at, in another context, at the continuing debate that's going on right now about whether or not directors ought to serve the interests primarily of shareholders or of something else. You're all familiar with that debate. It never seems to end, and Professor Shevitz has written a lot about it historically and otherwise. And whenever you begin to look at sort of the origins of that debate, you always come back at some point to the Dodd-Burley exchange in 1931-32. That's always a kind of a... some people think it started there. That surely did not. But it's a very kind of a pivotal moment in that debate. And it's very strange. Those articles are very strange for a number of reasons. On their surface, they appear to be simply Adolf Burley taking the position that corporate powers are powers in trust held for the benefit of the shareholders, as their interest may appear. He sort of uses that language. And Merrick Dodd, who was a professor at Harvard at the time, taking kind of the alternative position that, indeed, corporate directors not only should properly consider the interests of a number of other stakeholders, but that, indeed, that they did so and that that was admirable and desirable. That's on the surface what's going on, but when you begin to look more closely at exactly what they said, at the context in which they were writing, and the histories of the proponents themselves, Michael Wachter and Bill Bratton at Penn have written a lot about this, you realize there's something else going on. There's a context here that is in some ways lost to us today because we can't go back and see things as they did. So in the course of trying to figure out what was the context, what, for example, were students being taught in the 1930s at leading American law schools about the duty of directors? In the course of looking at that, I kept seeing references to this program, this Yale Law School, Harvard Business School combined law business program. And it was often alluded to kind of in footnote fashion. People would say, well, there was this course. William O. Douglas, who we'll talk about in a moment, who was really the person behind it. He refers to it in his autobiography, but again, just in kind of one line. And I thought it seemed like such a strange collaboration that I became very, very curious and started doing a lot of sort of archival work to kind of figure out what can we learn about that program? How on earth did this ever get started? What was it about? So that's what the paper is about. Now, the sad thing from my point of view is it would be nicer if I could say this program laid the groundwork for something really, really important today. That obviously was what I had hoped to find, that it was when archaeologists find something important, what they want to be able to say is this now provides the answer to this question that links this to that. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to offer quite that much promise. It seemed to have been a bit of a dead end. But having found out so much about it, I still think that it does offer something, if nothing else, an insight into what we might learn about why a program fails. But also, I think it does have perhaps something to say about where the state of law, corporate law, and finance was in the 1930s and why that might have had an impact on what happened. But the real problem may have been simply quite practical issues. So I'll tell you what I mean by that as I go on. So first, the context. So this program, this collaboration between the Yale Law School and the Harvard Business School, it occurs, it's a sort of a five-year thing. Perhaps we can go back to as early as 1929 when they started talking about it, but for it existed from 1933 to 1938. And it's important to remember what was going on at that time in the corporate law world. It was not a normal time. It was quite a remarkable time. So I've just put a few things just to remind you. There's Franklin Roosevelt giving his inaugural address when he was first elected. This, of course, was the period during which Burleigh and Means published The Modern Corporation and Private Property, a book which, depending on your point of view, is either a controversial book that too much has been written about, but nobody would deny that it is probably the most read book on corporate law in this century, whether you agree with it, disagree with it, think their methodology was flawed or not. No one denies that people read it. And that it's had an important influence. Of course, it was 33. It was the enactment of the Securities Act of 1933. Again, today, we tend to think of securities regulation almost as normal, but this was a very, very dramatic act for the federal government in the United States to enact federal legislation at a time when basically all U.S. states already had state regulation that operated quite differently. This was a radical step, and it was a controversial one. The Securities Act of 1933, again, as is often forgotten now, was challenged on constitutional grounds in 1933. It was thought to be a huge overstep by the federal government. And, of course, the Wall Street, the collapse of the market in 1929, as I like to remind people, my students and others, whenever you talk about the crash of 1929, it's important to remember that was absolutely not a one-day event or a two-day event. In fact, if you look at kind of what happened to the market after the crash in October of 1929, the market had largely recovered by the end of the year and into the early following year. In other words, if you had been alive in the early months of 1930, you might have thought, it's all over now. We had the crisis in October, but everything is now recovered. But of course, it was the beginning of the end. So the real problem, the stock market crash was not a one-day event or a one-month event. It was really a three-year event. The market really sort of continued to fall from 29 to 32 with ups and downs, so that when it was all over, about 90% of the stock market value had been wiped out. So this was an extraordinarily, an event the likes of which we've never seen before. We've seen larger one-day events, including in 1987, but we've never seen a kind of a sustained stock market loss such as what happened between 1929 and 1932. So these were kind of major events affecting people's confidence in the corporate system, confidence in the regulation of securities markets, and it's not surprising that it created a window for a level of regulatory intervention that frankly would not have happened without this sort of confluence of events. So that's sort of the context in which we get this program. Now, the head of the program, William O. Douglas, a remarkable figure, and if you're not familiar with Douglas's history, I won't go into it, but I commend you to it, because he is if you were to read sort of the Reader's Digest version of Douglas's career, it sounds like a series of remarkable hits. He was the youngest person ever appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was the longest-serving U.S. Supreme Court judge. He was the chair of the SEC, the third chair of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, to which he was appointed again at quite a young age. He was a Yale law professor, a Columbia law professor. He practiced briefly at the firm that is now Cravath's. It looks like sort of this remarkable list of accomplishments, and indeed it was, but he was also a very provocative figure, and again, since I think this might be recorded, I don't want to get into too many details of what people said about him, but he was a controversial figure. Have a look, for example, at what Richard Posner has written about Douglas. Posner, I think, was a clerk at the Supreme Court at the time that Douglas was serving there. So he is, in some ways, a kind of a polarizing figure, and he, I think I can say this, Posner used a stronger term, but he had some challenges with accuracy. opposed to use the phrase pathological liar, but I'm going to say he had challenges with accuracy. And you see it in even in when you compare the archival evidence about this program with what he said about it in his own autobiography, they don't match. I mean, and in some ways, not in significant ways, not in material ways. That's what makes it so strange. In other words, he seemed to. This is Douglas. He's crucial to understanding this program. Douglas wrote an article about a sort of a functional perspective on corporate law. He wrote this article in 1929. He is today associated with the realists. That's not a term he used about himself. He described himself as being a member of a group of sociological jurisprudes, but today we would say he was one of the realists. That paper he wrote on the functional perspective of corporate law really explains exactly what his theory was in trying to combine law and business studies in this program. Again, so it was a paper published in the University of Illinois Law Review in 1928. His perspective is one that kind of animates this. But I want to just have a quick digression to mention Adolph Burley for a moment. So Douglas was a law professor at Yale during the period that I'm going to talk about. Fairly briefly, he actually gets appointed to the SEC during the period of this program as part of the things that's one of the things that actually helps to kill this program. In other words, the champion leaves. And for anybody here, I know there's some law professors. For any innovative program within a law school, you've got to have a person behind it who champions it and who just doesn't give up. And if that person is removed, particularly if the program is an innovative one, it will not succeed because nobody else will have the energy that person had. So the fact that he left to go to the SEC is a big part of this story. But he was a professor at the same time as Burley was a professor at Columbia, as Merrick Dodd was a professor at Harvard. They were all, and they write to one another. In other words, there's interesting correspondence, and I'm going to show you one of them in just a moment. By the way, again, just by curious coincidence, this is 2024. This is the bicentennial of the Yale Law School. It's also the 100th anniversary of the introduction of the case method at the Harvard Business School. So 2024 has some significance. Again, I'm just trying to justify giving a historical presentation. Also, it's November 5th. Merrick Dodd, of the Dodd-Burley debates, died on November 4th of 1951 in a tragic car accident. I mean, he drove off a bridge and drowned. It was a horrible, horrible event, which, by the way, created a vacancy at Harvard, which was filled by Louis Loss. That's why Louis Loss came to Harvard, because they suddenly needed someone, because Merrick Dodd had died. All right. So after he wrote his paper on a functional approach to corporate law, and Douglas began to teach a course with Carol Shanks at the Yale Law School, which many people identify today as being the basis for the approach to the study of business associations or business organizations. Indeed, those course names, which became common at many American law schools, many law schools now have retreated back to calling the courses corporations. But for a time, business associations or business organizations was the name given to what in the UK is usually studied as company law. And the reason for those titles, they came out of Douglas and Shanks's work, was there was an it was thought that instead of just focusing on these sort of institutional structures, the corporation, the partnership, the limited partnership, whatever, that we instead should be identifying what's the function that these institutions perform, and that should be the organizing principle for these courses. That's where the idea of business associations and business organizations originally came from, and it came out of Douglas and Shanks's approach to the study of corporate law. Shanks, by the way, he didn't teach very long at Yale. He went to the Prudential Insurance Company, had a very successful career as an insurance executive. And when I say very successful, he appeared on the cover of Time magazine in a story which had identified him as the highest paid insurance executive in America. So he had a career very different from the career that many law professors enjoy, at least on the financial side. So Douglas and Burley and Dodd all moved in the same circles. And there was discussion at that time, late 1920s, about this new approach to the teaching of corporate law, this functional approach. Douglas had appeared, had spoken at a conference organized by Dodd in the late 1920s. And following that, hadn't really met Dodd. Following that, Douglas was organizing a conference and wanted to know who he could get to speak, other than, you know, himself, about the new approach to corporate law. So he wrote to Adolph Burley, and he said, "I've heard about this guy Dodd. Would you think he would be the one to speak?" Well, first I'm going to show you two things. I want to show you a little clip of Adolph Burley. So Adolph Burley, of the Burley-Dodd debates of the modern corporation and private property, was a very prominent figure as a young man during Franklin Delano Roosevelt's campaign. He was part of the Roosevelt's Brains Trust, although surprisingly, he didn't actually end up getting a major role in the administration, but people thought he was going to. Here's a newsreel clip from 1932. This is Adolph Burley. I hope it will run. Yeah. Turned out more unofficially. So that is Dodd in Adolph Burley in 1932, and even the short comment he makes there tells you exactly what Douglas was thinking. The world has changed. In particular, the institution of the Securities and Exchange Act means that lawyers are going to have to know more about business. They should be studying accounting. They should be studying, and that sort of is reflected in Burley's comments. But here's the letter I want to show you. Just to remind you, Burley and Dodd had this very famous exchange for whom are corporate managers, trustees. Burley taking the position that corporations should act for shareholders as their interest may appear. He later explains in an article in the 1960s that his main reason for saying this was that he just didn't think that directors were up to the job of managing these other interests, and he was concerned about accountability. If they're not accountable to shareholders, who are they accountable to? And Dodd takes this other position, and some people, including a former Delaware Chief Justice Leo Strine, have said Dodd was provoking Burley. In other words, Dodd was deliberately had identified in Burley's original article that he could be identified as a conservative, and so wrote an article to poke at him as though he were a conservative. And of course, Burley was outraged by that, because he did not. I mean, he famously said in a passage that is repeated in his papers to his wife that he wanted to be the American Karl Marx, by which he did not mean that he wanted to be he was talking about he wanted to have that kind of impact. He wanted to be sort of a certain kind of social prophet, but he certainly did not want to be identified as a conservative figure. He was very much in the view that that the government had to do some important things to intervene, a la FDR. All right, here is the letter. So Douglas writes to Burley and says, I'm putting together this conference. I'm trying to get some people to come who know about this new method of teaching corporate law, the functional approach. Douglas suggested, Joseph Beal, I think, should come. And what about this guy, Dodd? And here is the beginning of the letter. Dear Bill, Dodd might do. You probably know him. He's been working up a course along this time. I do not think he knows very much about it. But that is not the most dramatic part of this letter, look at this. So remember, this is 1930. The famous exchange between Dodd and Burley has not happened yet. My only quarrel with him, he plagiarized me. Now, this is a remarkable accusation. What it says is, my only quarrel with, he wrote an article including about three quarters of a chapter of my book without bothering to give me credit. But this kind of minor larceny is customary in the academic world. To my knowledge, I've never, the idea that Burley already had a gripe against Dodd on a very sort of a personal level, I had not heard this before. I found this, as I say, this is in Douglass's papers, so you wouldn't find it in Burley's papers. You wouldn't find it in Dodd's. It is in Douglass's papers at the Library of Congress. So I thought that was intriguing, just sort of for historical reasons. I then tried to find, I've tried to find the article. I assume the book he is talking about is the Studies in Law of Corporation Finance. It's a book that Burley wrote while he was teaching, not at the law school, but at the Harvard Business School. He taught a course in corporation finance and then wrote this book, a short book, Studies in Law of Corporation Finance. Dodd did write a few papers in that area. I've tried to, you know, to sort of make the case for this. I haven't been able to do that yet, but, you know, we'll see. All right, so what's the program? The program was proposed by Douglass. At the Yale Law School, there was a guy named Eugene Bates, or George Bates, I guess he went by, a Harvard Business School professor who had been brought to Yale as a sort of an adjunct to teach some business-related courses to law students. Originally, the dean of the Harvard Law School, Charles Clark, wanted Bates to come full-time. He had this, you come and be part of our faculty. Bates said he wouldn't do that, but that he would teach these courses one-off. It was while Bates was at the law school that he and Douglass began to collaborate on, what if we offered this joint program at the Yale Law School and the Harvard Business School? Now, an obvious question, there are two obvious questions that people might have about that. First of all, why two universities in two different, you know, historical rivals in two different cities? From the Yale's point of view, the answer is obvious. Yale had no business school. The Yale School of Management was not founded until 1976. So from Yale's point of view, they just, if they wanted to collaborate with business faculty, they couldn't get it at Yale. And by the way, there was a controversy. I mean, Yale didn't have a business school and didn't want one. In fact, the evidence is pretty clear. One of the worries of the Yale University, like not the law school, but the university, about this program was they thought it was a stealth action to try to get a business school to Yale. And it was so opposed by, you know, by many other people in the university that Clark had to keep saying, no, we're not saying, of course we don't want a business school. That would be, because at the time there was competing views about whether business schools belonged in traditional academic institutions. Harvard had that debate years earlier, and the Harvard Business School had already been in existence for more than a quarter of a century. But at Yale, they still weren't sure. So Yale didn't have a business school, so it's obvious why they needed to reach out to somebody else. But if the Harvard Business School wanted to collaborate with a law school, you know, it turns out Harvard also has a law school, as you may know. Why didn't they do a similar collaboration with the law school? Now, the answer to that question is everybody knows, but I can't prove. So what everybody says, including Douglass himself, he wrote about this in his autobiography, again, one line, Roscoe Pound, who was the dean of the Harvard Law School, it is said that he was opposed to this, that he would not collaborate with the business school. I have seen, and there's a quite a well-known legal historian, I can never pronounce his name, Daniel Chacolette, I may not have his name correctly, who writes about the Harvard Law School. I corresponded with him. He said that accords with his intuition about Pound, but I haven't been able to see any documents of Pound saying that he was against such a collaboration. There is evidence that the Harvard Business School did float the idea of a similar collaboration with the law school before this program was ever instituted. And it's also intriguing because the dean of the Harvard Business School at that time, a very famous dean, Wallace Dunham, if you kind of consider the history of deans of the Harvard Business School, Wallace Dunham is kind of an iconic figure because he's associated with the idea of trying to make business school a truly professional school and to make business managers professionals, by which I mean not just motivated by how much money can you make, but rather as sort of, you know, elder, a sort of statesman. And Dunham was a graduate of Harvard Law School. So Dunham himself had a legal background. If anyone would have been in the right position to try to coordinate a collaboration with law school, you might have thought it would be him. But there never was a collaboration between the Harvard Business School and the Harvard Law School at that time. And again, as I say, everyone says who talks about this says it was because of Roscoe Pound. I don't know whether that was true or not. In any event, Bates, George Bates from the Harvard Business School, William Douglas from the Harvard Law School, conceive of this program that will conceive of this program that will involve 4 years of study. The first year at the Harvard at the Yale Law School, the second year at the Harvard Business School, where the students would take a program, a modified version of the first year MBA program, and then return to the Harvard Law School to complete two more years. For the most part, those last 2 years would look the same as the second, third years of a Yale Law School program, but there were going to be some modified courses, including some special courses in which the language that Douglas uses over and over again when he writes about this, in which there would be the correlation would be established between law and business. That was what the program was. That's how it was conceived to operate. And it was launched mid-February of 1933. They got some good coverage. This is the story from the New York Times announcing the program when it was launched, February of 1933. This is a story from the Herald Tribune, which, when you read it, looks like it was, and probably was, it looked like it was written by the, you know, the marketing department of Yale. I mean, it says all of the things that the people in the program were saying about the program themselves. So this was kind of dictated to the reporter, but this story explains what the philosophy of the program was. And the part that I've highlighted says, when the Yale School of Law proposed this joint course, this is Dunham speaking, I gave the project that enthusiastic reception which might be expected from a member of the bar, because he had graduated from Harvard Law School, who has found a major part of his time occurred with business problems. Now, one of the reasons that I wanted to highlight that is, notice that he says when the Yale Law School promoted this, it was crucial to people at the Harvard Business School, and again, this comes through in the correspondence repeatedly. It was crucial to the business school that this be that the Yale Law School be seen as the initiator of this program. They said it over and over again. We have to report this as you came to us and we said we would help you. And there was even there's some correspondence between Dunham and Roscoe Pound when they're going to announce this, sort of saying, well, you know, Yale has come to us and they've approached this and I'd like to talk to you. And the timing of that letter gives the impression that Yale has just come to us and we're thinking about it, when in fact the program is basically done. In other words, that conversation was going to be So presumably the reason for that was that the business school did not want to give the impression that they had gone to Yale to get something they couldn't get at home, but rather that they were sort of helping out sort of colleagues in arms, I guess. But that was extremely important to the people at the business school, that this be seen as a Yale Law School initiative. Here's how it appeared this is the Yale Law School Bulletin for 1933-34. So this is the year that it was introduced. It's just some general language that talks about what we think we're doing. They explain the program just as I've explained it to you, first year at Yale Law School, second year at the Harvard Business School, then come back to the Yale Law School, and where you get your these correlating courses, and they try to sort of pitch why they would matter. Okay, now, I want to just talk a little bit about, check my time here, yeah, a little bit about the numbers. As I said, the program failed. I want to give you a sense of sort of how badly it failed. So in the first year, it was launched in 1933-34. They had, that year, they got about 15 students who were interested in doing this. Their target had been 20. So what they had said when they were conceiving the program, they said, it's going to be a small program. It's going to be a select program. We hope we have the best students. We think 20 to 25 would be the maximum, but we want a minimum of 12. That was sort of what the people had in mind. They got 15 that first year. And then the following year, it just dropped. Initially only about 6 students were interested in it. Then it went up, they managed to get it up to about 8. And so during sort of each year of the program, they were having increasing problems getting enough people for it to make any, for it to make any sense to run at all. So during this period of declining numbers, people were trying to identify what they thought was going wrong. Now, as I mentioned, it was a few things sort of all, as in our own lives, a lot of things begin to happen simultaneously when you start, you try to break them down into sort of line items. You forget, well, actually, there was a lot of stuff happening at the same time. For example, let's just start with the dean of Yale when Douglas first came was Robert Hutchins. He was the one, and that first slide I show you when I showed a picture of William Douglas, that statement that he was the outstanding professor, that was a statement made by Hutchins. Hutchins left shortly after Douglas came to go to the University of Chicago, be their dean. And as soon as he left, he began trying to recruit Douglas to Chicago. And offered him huge sums of money. And when I say huge sums of money, at that time, the highest salary for a law professor at Chicago was $10,000 a year. He offered Douglas $20,000. It was unprecedented. And, now oddly, Douglas in his autobiography says the number was 25. It's absolutely not true. But anyway, I don't know why. He could have just forgotten, I suppose. It was a long time. But that number, it's always hard to make sense of a number. I use one of those inflation calculators you can get in Google. I don't know how accurate they are. The one I looked at suggested that would be about $485,000 today. I think that's probably too high. I don't think that probably is accurate. But it was a significant salary. And if you look, Yale claims that Hutchins left. At one point on Yale Law School's website, where they talk about the history of the faculty, they actually say that Douglas left to go to Chicago. Because probably the reason that the person writing that said that was that he does appear in the University of Chicago's, their equivalent to the Bulletin, the year after Hutchins recruited him. Because the negotiations were so far advanced, Hutchins thought he was coming. He never came. He did not go to Chicago. They made him a counteroffer, and he stayed. But that change of dean mattered, because Charles Clark, who was the dean who replaced Hutchins, apparently had very little enthusiasm for this program. But he said publicly that he liked it. In other words, he talked, it's really important to us, really important to us, but later on in a comment that he made to someone, he said he basically had to pay lip service to this because there were some people on the faculty who liked it, but he never thought it was an asset for the school. So I think that also is kind of revealing. Although he claimed to be supportive, it's not clear that he was a kind of an enthusiastic supporter. In order to try to get the numbers up, they reduced the program from a 4-year program to a 3-year program because they thought one of the problems was people were having to pay tuition for 4 years. And I should say, from the student's point of view, here's how it worked. You paid Yale tuition when you were at Yale, which was $450 a year. You paid Harvard Business School tuition when you were at Harvard that 1 year, which was $600 a year. So they had to pay an extra year's tuition, and it was higher than any of the classmates. But the real stumbling block, Harvard never offered the students a degree. And this was a key negotiating point when they first began. The understanding was Harvard was not going to offer them an MBA because they had not completed 2 years at the business school. That was understood. But the thinking was they would offer them a degree, which would be new for Harvard, a Bachelor of Business Administration. So that was supposed to be the deal. When I say supposed to be, it was never agreed to, but that was the understanding as to where they would get. Dunham kept saying, the problem is the Harvard Business School could not on its own agree to that. In other words, the Harvard Corporation had to agree, the Central University had to agree to that. And he did not believe that the president of the university would be susceptible to that until the program had run for a few years and shown that it was successful. And so there was a sort of a chicken and egg problem, if I'm using that in the right way here, and that is the enrollment was low, at least in part, because there was no second degree, even though you had to do an extra year. And Dunham kept saying, we got to have high enrollment before the university will agree that it's worthwhile to grant the degree. And that comes through very clearly in the sort of the back and forth, because the Yale people were very angry about this. Charles Clark, in particular, thought this was sort of outrageous, that they won't give a degree, and that's what's hurting this program more than anything else. But it wasn't the only thing that was hurting the program. You don't have to think about this for more than 30 seconds to see why this is a very, very challenging. This would be a challenging program to offer today. And in the 1930s, people had to physically relocate. So they were living. They would be living in New Haven for a year, and then they would have to physically locate to Cambridge for a year, pay rent in Cambridge, find a place to live. And again, there was all kinds of quite banal correspondence, as the professors in this program are trying to save it, are trying to find places to live for these students, because it was a problem. So that was there were a lot of practical reasons that made it difficult, but the lack of degree was one. So what did they get? I like this. Okay, this is a handwritten George Bates he said, let's give them a certificate, and he puts together this little certificate. It's pretty clear from the context in which that appears in Bates's papers that this was not something he spent a lot of, this was literally something like, we'll give him this. Now, I couldn't find the only example of an actual certificate that people were given. Harvard, in a kind of a retrospect, published some stuff, some memorabilia. And in that, there's the certificate that people actually got. It's identical. All they've done is they've taken Bates' thing and they just said, we'll put the real logos on there. So that's what they got. And that's the only thing they got that was different from what every other Yale Law School got. It's just a little certificate saying you've completed this Yale Law School and Harvard Business School thing that's signed by, it's signed by the dean of the Harvard Business School and the dean of the Yale Law School. It was pretty clear, Charles Clark talks about this as he's trying to save the program, that students, the reason it was unattractive to Yale Law students was our students don't think it helps them get jobs, that our best students are pretty confident that they will get jobs without this anyway, and so it, without the degree, there just wasn't enough on the line to justify doing this. I could talk a bit more about how the program was structured and what was in it, but if people are interested, I can talk about that because I'm ending out of time. So the program ends December 1938, where they pull the plug. By that time, Douglas was gone. He had gone first to the SEC in 1939. He's appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Charles Clark, also gone. Charles Clark became a judge as well. So the program winds up. I just want to mention one thing about fees. So the program winds up, and as it does, a fight begins between the law school and Harvard over fees. Here's why. The Harvard Business School complained that the fee arrangements weren't fair. They say, you, Yale, you're getting 3 years of tuition, even though part of the program involves Harvard Business School professors coming to Yale in the second and third years to teach some courses. We're not getting anything for that. The professors were. But they meant at the university level, they weren't getting anything for it. And this just isn't fair, so you've got to do something about this. And so they said, you have to pay us $10,000 a year as a subvention, just a straight-up payment. Some of that will go to the professors, about 3,000 or so, and the rest we keep as a, you know, because it's, we got administrative costs. Yale didn't agree to 10, but they did agree to 5. So they paid 5,000 a year, of which 3,000 went to the professors, 2,000 was maintained by Harvard. When the program ended, it ended in December, which meant that no Yale students came to Harvard in the spring. And so Charles Clark took the view, well, that means we don't have to pay the $3,000 that we still owe you. And Harvard said, yes, you do. And there was a dispute over what that money was for. And so Clark said, we were only paying you that money because you were supposed to develop specialized materials for our law students. Since there are not going to be any law students, we assume you don't need to develop any specialized materials for the students who aren't there, so we shouldn't have to pay. And Harvard's response was, no, we think it's a subvention for other reasons. That it was only structured in the way it was because of our salary schedules. In other words, we didn't want to advertise that our professors were getting extra money to teach at the Yale Law School. And so there was this sort of bickering over salaries when the business school couldn't get satisfaction from Clark. They went over his head. They went to the president of the university and complained. Clark then gets appointed to the bench, and while on the bench, is still fighting this battle. And the correspondence gets angrier and angrier. He says, you're engaged in hard trading. That's the phrase Clark uses. It's inappropriate. And you went over my head, so maybe you can just deal with the president now. So it was kind of unfortunate in all kinds of ways. But I mean, the importance of fees to the university is not a modern problem, is the point. All right, why? Another suggestion. So when Roberta Romano at Yale, in commenting on an earlier version of this paper, she said, you know, one reason that the program might have failed was that it was too soon in the development of legal theory, finance theory. In other words, there was no theoretical content. And because a course like this depended on it being something special and theoretical, that may have been a problem. Now, this is kind of interesting for two reasons. When Yale first proposed to try to save the program by reducing it from a 4-year to a 3-year program, you know, to try to make it cost less and not take as much time for students, this created a problem for them with the state bar examiners. In other words, their accreditation. Because the Connecticut Bar Association looked at it and said, well, we think this program, not only do we think this program may not satisfy, students aren't getting enough law, and therefore they may not be, we think maybe we may even have to pull Yale's accreditation altogether. And they had this sort of this review thing. There's one line that appears in it, criticizing Yale. There seems to be a strong tendency to get away from the study of the fundamental principles of the common law and to research and specialize branches of law or law and business. And they go on to talk about other things. After saying that, they don't like this law and business program, they then take a gratuitous shot at a whole bunch of other Yale courses, which again, this is back in the this was 1938. Anybody who works at a law school now will be very, very familiar. So they go through every course, including they didn't like comparative law. That seemed to be, you know, what does a practitioner in Connecticut need to know about that? They literally say this. So they take this shot at Yale, saying if this program may threaten your accreditation. Charles Clark writes back this wonderful kind of withering attack, it's beautifully done. It is exactly kind of what you would expect from an academic defending his institution, and he does it brilliantly. And that just ends it. They don't respond. So one possibility is, this is paradoxically, it's not practical enough. The objection of the Connecticut Bar Association is, this is too theoretical. You've lost track of what practitioners need. And the other possibility is it wasn't theoretical enough. Now, I just, this is a comment, or it's a quote from the introduction to Robert Merton's book on continuous time finance. Robert Merton, his father was a very famous sociologist, Robert K. Merton. But this is Robert C. Merton, won the Nobel Prize in 1997 for option pricing theory. In his book on continuous time finance, he's noting the fact that theoretical content in finance courses is quite new. That basically, it's kind of, this is one of these, you might translate this as when I grew up, all you did in a finance course was decide whether NPV was better than IRR. You know, that's as theoretical as it got. And his point being, it's come a long way. We are a new generation, and any of you familiar with Merton's book, Continuous Time Finance, it's a very challenging book in every way. So if you go back to 1938, IRR was invented in 1935. The concepts embedded in IRR, you can go back earlier, but the term is an article by K. E. Boulding, 1935, that introduces internal rate of return. And NPV, different people, it may have been Keynes, may have been somebody else, but that coined that. But these were, so we are right in the 1930s, even what he dismisses as, pretty simplistic stuff, even that was brand new. So perhaps Professor Romano is right that there just wasn't enough theoretical content to make this interesting. And if all this was, Douglas's intention was pretty clearly a theoretical approach. He writes, this is a collection of Douglas essays, but he gave a lecture in 38 where he talked about the notion that law schools are not about just preparing people for practice. In fact, the only thing that matters in a law school, the only thing that lasts is theory. Everything else changes by the time you graduate. Douglas clearly had a theoretical goal, but it may have been there just wasn't it just wasn't there. The field had not yet caught up to his ambition. I mean, that's one possibility. Or perhaps it was just a question of all of these practical things, cost, the relocation to Cambridge, the extra 4 years with no extra degree, the fact that Yale Law School graduates were already highly marketable, and so anyone who was thinking of this as a career, as needed for a career, would be hard to make the case. Maybe all of those things and the content of the program may have been largely irrelevant. The last thing I was going to mention, but I'm not going to. I was going to draw a parallel to what's happening. Roberto Romano wrote a piece called "After the Revolution in Corporate Law," which talks about the impact of modern financial theory on modern legal education, and it may very well be that what happened in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the revolutionary impact that had on legal education may be an exact answer to what she was saying, that we now do have that theoretical component, and that may explain why we can have successfully MBA JD programs. The first MBA JD program, at least at a major university, was at Stanford in 1966. Harvard begins theirs in 1969, Chicago in 1970, many years after this sort of abortive attempt between the Harvard Business School and the Yale Law School in 1930s. I can see I'm running out of time. I'm going to stop right there.